From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, filling in for Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Lost Malaysian airline flight MH370 is being covered by CNN. In fact, Flight 370 and nothing else is being covered by CNN. Over the past 7 weeks, the channel has all but passed on the collapse of the Mideast peace process, a deadly mudslide in Washington state, and a Russian land grab in Ukraine. The monomania has made the channel an object of ridicule.
Let's recap CNN's last week of the missing Malaysian airliner coverage. There is a lot of non-Malaysian airliner garbage in the ocean, the heavier of which sinks, the lighter of which floats. Let us go now to Wolf Blitzer in the new Duh Room.
Somehow unchastened by the mockery, perhaps because it is now running a slightly less distant third after Fox and MSNBC, CNN is showing no signs of moving off the airplane story. That, even though it is thinking aloud about the frightening open-endedness of it all.
Could any of the investigators' assumptions up until this point have been wrong? Of course, that's what many people are asking. And what does this mean if they are going to have to recalculate the entire search at some point?
CNN's long slide from hard news to morbid infotainment has caught the attention of Andrew Tyndall, who runs the television news monitoring site The Tyndall Report. He says that the cable channel risks losing its reputation, or what little remains of it, as a news organization. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
To be fair, Flight 370 is a mystery wrapped in an enigma shrouded in tragedy, heavily covered by all the cable channels and major networks, no?
Absolutely. It's a marvelous news story. Headline-grabbing, tugs at the heartstrings, and is absolutely mystifying to anybody who hears about it.
But
it's one plane that went missing, and it went missing 6 weeks ago. You know, it's not just there's very little happening. This is television, and there are very few pictures happening. There's actually nothing to see. CNN has been forced to resort to studios full of experts opinionating on what might have happened to the plane, but testing various theories to see whether they hold water or not.
Yeah, it's opinionating, speculating, in some cases, I would say fantasizing.
Or, you know, engaging in astrophysics. I mean, what happened if the plane was sucked into a black hole?
A lot of people have been asking about that, about black holes and on and on and on, and all of these conspiracy theories. I know it's preposterous, but is it preposterous, you think, Mary?
Is it preposterous, Andrew?
Yes, it is preposterous, Bob.
Now, the explanation for all of this apparently is just the retooling of the channel by its relatively new president, Jeff Zucker, for a competitive advantage against Fox News Channel and MSNBC, who week after week for years have just been eating CNN's lunch.
Zucker arrived to run CNN, and he said he wanted a fresh definition of what news was. In other words, news didn't consist of policy and politics, but of fresh subject matter. And what we've seen is a move towards news which isn't to do with policy or politics, but is to do with excitement, mystery, and human interest.
In his takedown, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show showed that CNN was so bereft of stuff to talk about concerning Flight 370 that they actually deployed their feature reporter, Jeannie Mose, to do a piece about another CNN reporter, Martin Savage, spending a month in a flight simulator. But that's not all. They also interviewed Brian Stelter, their media show host and media correspondent, essentially to defend the network against criticism from the likes of Stewart and us. Let's hear what he has to say.
We used to live in a world of media scarcity, but now we live in this world of media infinity, where you can find whatever you're interested in on the internet and on television. As a result, it makes more sense to have channels like CNN or Fox or MSNBC that are focused on one story at a time when there's a big news story happening.
He went on to cite a Pew poll which said that about half of the public thinks they're getting just about the right amount of coverage on Flight 370.
There are always two concerns that a news organization needs to have. It needs to have the immediate concern, am I addressing stories and issues that are of interest to my audience? And it has a long-range concern, am I maintaining my reputation as the go-to place for legitimate news gathering? The danger of pandering to ratings is if you do so at the expense of your long-range reputation, then it'll do you no good at all.
Now, there is an odd kind of historical irony about all of this. While I'm perfectly happy to find fault with CNN for betraying its news roots, actually, it's going back directly to its news roots. Tell me when CNN broke out to begin with.
CNN broke out in the early 90s, 25 years ago, and it did so with two major stories. One was a legitimate major news story which deserved 24-hour coverage, and that was the war to get Iraq out of Kuwait. The second one, which got just as much coverage, was a story that is really similar in its format and structure to the Malaysia Airlines story, and that was the trial of O.J. Simpson. The trouble is the difference between the O.J. Simpson trial and the narrative structure of the Malaysian Airlines story is CNN executives were certain that the O.J. Simpson trial would actually have a climax, which is a verdict. What's happening here is the story is just carrying on and on and on, and it's just going to tail off into nothingness, and they've got no way of tying it up in a nice, neat bow.
Well, on the subject of nothingness, I have to say, Andrew, I think you're being harsh. In some ways, the CNN coverage has been illuminating. I want to play something that, well, it's an education.
By the time you get to the bottom of the Indian Ocean, anywhere out here, you're going to be so deep that there is really no light whatsoever. It's going to be flat out dark down there.
It turns out the bottom of the ocean is dark, and in the dark, it's hard to see things.
But Bob, is it as dark as a black hole?
Andrew, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Bob.
Andrew Tindall is the publisher of The Tindall Report.
This week, the FCC dealt what many have called the final death blow to network neutrality, the principle that all content, whether it comes from Netflix or a scrappy new tech startup, should be treated equally on the internet. On Thursday, the FCC announced that it would consider a new draft of the Open Internet or net neutrality rules that would allow internet services to pay broadband carriers for better access. What does this mean and why does it matter? Most importantly, how might this affect your movie watching? Siva Vaidyanathan, chair of the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia, isn't buying FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler's rationale that reports of net neutrality's death are, quote, flat out wrong.
I think Chairman Wheeler is being disingenuous at best. The rules that he's proposing would create two lanes, two tiers of internet service. Either you're going to be in the fast lane where you pay a tremendous amount to get your content to people, or you're going to be in the slow lane because you're not willing to pay that extortion fee, and you better hope that your video comes over ungarbled.
Vaidyanathan says no matter how Wheeler spins it, the government is giving big cable a license for blackmail.
What we're seeing now is the capitulation to the political power of Comcast. Comcast is metastasizing. It's picking up other major providers. It's about to have a merger with Time Warner Cable. It now owns all of the NBC properties and all of that content, including the Olympics. That's a tremendous amount of not only cultural power, but political power. So what you're actually seeing here through the FCC is a recognition that Comcast is too big to mess with.
The FCC chairman is a former cable lobbyist, correct? So are you tying a direct link here between him and Comcast and net neutrality and essentially Washington?
I think everyone who works at the FCC right now, top to bottom, staff and commissioners, are sincerely committed to having the best possible open internet rules. The political realities in Washington, D.C. are not letting them accomplish what they want. This is more surrender than corruption. The basic fact is by creating this two-tiered system and charging these companies a premium to have their video delivered at a high rate, you're basically locking out any newcomers to the market. And so we're not going to see the next Skype, the next YouTube, the next Netflix anytime soon.
The proposal says that broadband providers would be required to act in what they call, quote, a commercially reasonable manner. So startups could technically appeal to the FCC on those grounds, right? I mean, what does commercially reasonable mean?
Nobody knows what commercially reasonable means, right? We have to assume that that means there can't be behavior that locks out legitimate competitors based on price discrimination, for instance, or anything else that would be an automatic flag of antitrust law. But, you know, that reasonableness standard is not something that an entrepreneur is going to want to bet on. It's not something that an investor or a venture capital firm is going to want to bet on. You're basically taking a lot of the confidence out of the system when it comes to invention and investment.
Back in February, we heard that Netflix made a deal with Comcast to get put on the fast lane. Are they sort of willing players in this discussion, or do they just feel like, you know what, we have no choice here?
I feel sorry for them. Netflix really needs to be in the good graces of Comcast. Netflix very much needs to be able to arrive in our homes in a strong and viable form so that people don't give up on Netflix. And in the absence of network neutrality, Comcast has no reason to be nice to Netflix.
I mean, really, should we feel sorry for Netflix, though? Shouldn't we be asking them to stand up for us, the consumer? Because they are the ones that we want. A lot of people don't care how they get their internet service. They just want the content. Isn't this a sort of key moment that potentially we, the consumer, can stand tall with our content providers and say, no, this is important. We want to be able to get it, and we don't want to be bullied.
We used to be able to depend on other big countervailing forces to protect network neutrality. We used to be able to depend on Google and Facebook and Amazon, because there was a time not long ago when those companies saw as their present and their future the old-fashioned internet as their outlet. That's how they got to us. None of those companies take seriously that cord coming out of our walls anymore. Those companies have all bet on a very different set of arrangements, one that involves other proprietary distribution networks delivering mobile signals and delivering their content through our mobile devices. But they're also counting on eventually being able to link together all the different devices and platforms in our lives. They're looking forward to data flowing through our eyeglasses and our automobiles and our coffee makers and our fridges. They're all trying to be the master of the operating system of our entire lives. They're not so worried about video streaming per se.
You know, I've covered a lot of community broadband networks, mesh networks, Google Fiber growth into dozens of cities, or it's coming into dozens of cities in the U.S. Are these a possible workaround if you can't beat them, sort of just pretend they're not there? Is that a possibility, municipal broadband?
Municipal broadband offers us great opportunity to make up for Comcast. Unfortunately, municipal broadband is really hard to execute. The city of Philadelphia tried it a number of years ago. Unfortunately, that's where Comcast lives too. And the government of Pennsylvania decided that cities in Pennsylvania should not be able to compete directly with Comcast. So that was a dream that never happened. With Google Fiber, Google is proving to the world that you can have insanely fast broadband connection with super high quality signals, video and otherwise, at low cost with network neutrality. Now, does that mean that we should depend on Google to roll that out in American cities over the next 10 years? It depends on whether ultimately Google finds this in their interest. And I don't have a lot of hope that Google wants it to be anything more than an experiment or a demonstration of what could happen. What we really need is policy in the public interest, policy shaped toward the future based on a commitment to competition and creativity. We've been attacking these issues in piecemeal fashion, and it's been something close to a disaster over the past decade.
Siva, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Siva Vaidyanathan is the chair of the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia and the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry.
Coming up, unless the Supreme Court stymies a state law against lying in political campaigns, the 2014 elections could set off an Ohio crime spree.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code PRIVACY. On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. Find out how LegalZoom can help you start and protect your business through incorporation, LLCs, nonprofits, trademarks, and more. LegalZoom has helped start over 1 million businesses and received an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. More information at LegalZoom.com. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Anoush Zamarodi.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Susan B. Anthony List versus Driehaus, a case that could help decide whether it's illegal to lie during a political campaign. In Ohio, where the case originated, it is a crime to knowingly or recklessly lie about a political candidate or ballot initiative, a law both righteous and absurd. Yes, truth is the soul of justice, but depriving a candidate of the lie is like depriving a butcher of his cleaver. And then there's that pesky First Amendment, which protects speech, and especially political speech, from government censorship. A clash of noble principles, this is. Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and he's been following the case. Adam, welcome back to OTM.
Good to be here, Bob.
Tell me more about this Ohio law. Is it unique in the 50 states, or are there others like it?
Turns out that about 15 states have similar laws. And as you say, on some level, I suppose it's a good idea. Lying in politics is both routine but not desirable. At the same time, the way these laws are set up, they really test the boundaries of the First Amendment's protections. The Ohio law is incredibly broad. It allows anybody to bring an action against anybody else. So if you or I posted something on Facebook that somebody didn't like, we could be hauled before an election commission made up of bureaucrats who would make a judgment about whether our speech was true or not. A first offense could get you 6 months in jail, and a second offense could disenfranchise you. You could lose your right to vote. The plaintiffs in this case say that the mere existence of this law really chills their right to free speech.
Explain, please, what this particular case, Susan B. Anthony List versus Driehaus, is all about.
So this outfit wanted to put up a billboard saying the candidate supported taxpayer-funded abortion.
The outfit being Susan B. Anthony List, an anti-abortion advocacy group, the candidate being Stephen Driehaus.
Exactly right. And that statement may be said to be truthy. He did vote for the Affordable Care Act. You can read various provisions of that if you have a strong cup of coffee and an accountant by your side to endorse the view that that's tantamount to voting for taxpayer-funded abortion. But it's not the only obvious reading of the law. And the billboard company, after being contacted by the candidates, said they would not run the ad. They were afraid of being dragged into this litigation. And the election board issued a finding of probable cause that there was a lie here. The election came and went. The action was dropped. And the immediate question for the U.S. Supreme Court was not the delicious one of is the law constitutional, but rather a preliminary one of in these circumstances did Susan B. Anthony List have standing to sue?
Questionable standing because, as it turned out, Driehaus lost the election, so their failure to get that billboard posted caused them no obvious harm.
True, and my sense of where the Supreme Court is on this, at least on that preliminary question of can they sue, the answer will almost certainly be yes. And I would also think that if the ultimate question is the law constitutional and reaches the court, they're very likely to say no, in large part because only a couple terms ago they said that some knucklehead who walked around lying about having received the Congressional Medal of Honor couldn't be prosecuted for that, even though there was a federal law that made it a crime.
Now, that's the Alvarez case.
Exactly.
This was a candidate who puffed up his resume to include the Congressional Medal of Honor, which he had not won, and was prosecuted under the Stolen Valor Act, written for precisely such a situation. But the Supreme Court said that, no, the Stolen Valor Act is an overbroad chilling of one's personal right to lie his ass off.
And that was a slightly surprising decision, and it went against statements in earlier decisions that said the First Amendment doesn't protect lies. But the court said that unless there's a clear harm that flowed from the speech, You know, libel still exists, but free-floating lies that have no special consequences can't be made criminal. That a law making such lies criminal violates the First Amendment. And if that's true in the medals setting, it almost surely carries over to the setting of these laws try to regulate more generally political campaigns.
There does seem to be an underlying riddle here, kind of Gordian knot of democracy. And that is, this is a nation of laws, and laws are theoretically based on truth, and truth is sacrosanct. You can be sent to jail for lying under oath, and yet the country's also built on the First Amendment, which lets you get away with almost anything. Is this an irresistible force against an immovable object?
It really boils down to the question of whom do we trust to make these judgments? Do you trust a presumably informed and skeptical citizenry to make wise judgments about the nonsense that pollutes our airwaves? Or do you trust a set of government bureaucrats, some of them self-interested, some of them partisan, to make a judgment on behalf of the government with criminal penalties flowing from it about whether something is true or not?
So if the court rules as you suspect it will, is this a victory for truthiness?
Yes, it's a runaway 9-0 truthiness victory.
All right, Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times.
There is a place where politicians can spin fluffy yarns without having to worry about being fact-checked, in the celebrated literary genre of the campaign memoir. This week, Elizabeth Warren released a memoir called A Fighting Chance, chronicling her unlikely rise from hardscrabble Oklahoma City to Harvard Law School and the U.S. Senate. Hillary Clinton's upcoming book, Hard Choices, promises, quote, candid reflections about key moments during her time as Secretary of State. Even fictional Vice President Selina Meyer on the HBO series Veep has entered the fray.
New beginnings, our next American journey.
What do you think of that title?
Well, it's so full of There's a colon right smack dab in the middle.
Oh, God. They kept coming up with all of these awful titles. You wouldn't even have believed it. Like, Footsteps to the Future was one. Red, White, and You was actually another one. Yes. Hands of Our Children.
What?
It's like a massacre or something.
It's f-ing sick.
I know.
As Casey Sepp writes in Politico magazine, penning a memoir has become de rigueur for political hopefuls looking to energize voters. But she says the books themselves have the authenticity and literary gravitas of The Wizard of Oz.
This idea of the yellow brick road where heartless prose, brainless policy prescription, and cowardly confession meet. So it's an exercise in saying a lot without saying very much.
One of the ones that people usually say that they liked was The Audacity of Hope, of course, Barack Obama's book. Does that fit into this genre?
You know, you're looking at an extended version of what became his campaign stump speech.
There was, and always had been, another tradition to politics. A tradition that stretched from the days of the country's founding to the glories of the civil rights movement. A tradition based on the simple idea that we have a stake in each other, and that what binds us together is greater than what drives us apart.
Rather than deal in fine point political recommendations, or rather than address specific issues from his run for state senate, what you have is this kind of broad, smarmy look at the American political landscape. I actually think Dreams from My Father is the better book.
That's so sad. You can go from being like a great writer to being sort of a crappy one simply because you have political ambition.
Sure, there's a lot on the line. I think it's really dangerous to be too candid about yourself or your own ideas for the country.
Okay, here's Mitt Romney reading from his memoir, No Apology, The Case for American Greatness.
Running for president of the United States is an extraordinary experience. New profound friendships are unquestionably the greatest reward. They will last a lifetime. And there were moments of laughter, such as when Ann got up from a collapsed stage in Dubuque, Iowa, dusted herself off, and later ad-libbed, "Well, I fell on the butt in Dubuque."
I might have underestimated the virtues of the audiobooks. You know, you can torture political reporters with them. One of my favorites is this peculiar section in Charlie Crist's book where he chooses to make this incredibly metaphoric moment out of the hug he shared with President Obama. And he says, "We shook hands. The new president leaned forward and gave me a hug. Reach, pull, release." It's just laughable. You know, my goodness, who knew so much depended on a hug?
Well, you know, he got a whole like half page out of that moment, right?
Yeah, exactly. Then you begin to see that, you know, years and years of public service can be reduced to these kind of silly paragraphs about irrepresentative moments.
But bad writing or not, Casey, there's still big money involved for the politicians. The advances are still huge, right?
Sure. If they're famous enough to be offered in advance, you're talking six figures. So, you know, Sarah Palin's was a little larger than most, $1.25 million. Somebody like Scott Brown got $700,000, Marco Rubio, $800,000.
I mean, and part of me says, you know, what's wrong with that? These are people who have given their lives to public service. They should be given the opportunity to make some real money, since they're probably being paid less than they would be paid if they were working for a corporation or something.
Sure, and I absolutely think we should hear reflections on public life. I just don't think that's what these books have actually come to be. So beyond that advance, you know, there's money involved throughout the process. They get the advance. They're able to sell their political list to promote the book. Their political action committees buy copies to take it to the top of the bestseller lists. They use the copies they've bought to incentivize donations to the PACs. And then the book tour becomes just an exercise in earned media. You have a way of spending, you know, 2 to 4 weeks on the campaign trail, but expensing it in a new way because it's for the book tour. So, you know, you've exhausted coverage on the political page, and then suddenly you're getting book reviews in the arts and culture section. Local papers are covering every reading. That's a, you know, a whole new audience of people you can talk to.
How much do the books end up being sort of a playbook for the campaign itself, that it gives them the opportunity to say, you know, if they're ever asked a hard question, it's in my book?
I think it happens pretty often. I think really the best example, Marco Rubio, An American Son, so comes out in 2013. It's clearly in anticipation of what might later be a national run. And there are very serious allegations in his past about the abuse of campaign funds and misuse of party credit cards. And it's dismissed with a sentence. And, you know, the sentence is, for much of my political career, I was young, very busy, very inexperienced, and sometimes I was sloppy. Well, that's not a sufficient explanation, and it's one that we shouldn't accept in future campaigns. But by saying I address those record-keeping issues in my memoir, the press moves on.
In terms of looking at the history of literary genres, this is a relatively new one, right? Would our founding fathers have dreamt of writing campaign memoirs?
No. I mean, Lincoln at one point during the campaign was asked by someone else who was working on a biography to talk about his childhood, and he really dismissed the idea that there was anything worth talking about, much less that he would have written about it. The Renaissance comes in 1976. Jimmy Carter, who's obviously, you know, well-known in Georgia but not yet a viable national candidate, he wrote a memoir, Why Not the Best? So the book comes out, and it's actually a great vehicle for launching his story. Since then, you can't stop these folks from writing books.
You know, Jimmy Carter, it was the peanut farmer that made him
right.
accessible to people. They want to hear the little personal anecdotes, the falling on the debut in Dubuque. That's what they want, right? It's those little morsels of humanity.
I'm not sure it's what anyone wants, but it certainly fills airtime. So it's understandable how they come to be. I mean, I would say try for Dreams from My Father. There's a reason that book will be read many years after President Obama's presidency. So I would say, you know, if you can't do it, find the ghostwriter who helps you actually confront your personhood. Make it a reflection on your life, what you've done, what you've already accomplished. Those are the things, I think, that help us make sense of who these people are. And that's what we want from these books.
Casey, thanks so much.
Sure.
Casey Sepp is a writer from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. She wrote about bad campaign memoirs in Politico magazine.
Coming up, don't be rude to your driver. It goes on your permanent record.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Anoush Zamarodi. A few months ago, I joined Uber, the app-based car service that connects riders with available drivers in their area. On my very first day, I used the service for 3 different rides. And on the last ride, I learned something upsetting. My driver told me that because I had such a low passenger rating, he almost didn't pick me up. That was a shock. Consumer ratings are an internet staple, but usually it's the consumer doing the rating. This two-way street isn't really publicized by the company, so I decided to do some investigative passenging.
Do you want to say your name?
My name is Ganyu Salami.
Now, when this ride is over, I get to rate you 1 through 5 stars, and then you get to rate me, right?
We have to do good for each other.
You think it's a great idea?
Absolutely. It's excellent good.
Tell me about when you rate your customers, what do you judge them on? What's your criteria?
Let's say you get inside my car. You late already. You know you're supposed to be at your job at 10 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And you get inside my car uh-huh. 5 minutes to 10. And you know it's not possible to get there in 5 minutes. And you get inside a car and you have a attitude like, oh, it's too much traffic. Oh, you're supposed to go this way, you're supposed to go this way. Definitely have to give you bad start.
So there's a saying, I'm sure you've heard it, that the customer is always right. Do you think the customer is always right, or does the new technology make things more equal?
Nah, the customer is not always right. It's not.
Looking back at my 2 Uber rides that could have led to my own bad rating, I can assume that it either came from the driver who didn't like me telling him that I was going to Clinton Avenue, not Clinton Street, thank you, or it was the driver who didn't like me wearing my headphones during the trip. Neither situation seemed like a punishable offense to me. But according to University of Denver law professor Nancy Leong, there is the potential to get a bad rating for much less, just for being who you are. Leong says a big problem with the customer rating system is its potential to be discriminatory, because like all online bellyaching, the commenter needn't face the commentee.
The driver doesn't have to look the passenger in the eye when the driver is giving the passenger a rating. If a driver sees a request for a pickup come in from a passenger who has uploaded a photo, and the driver sees that the passenger is a racial minority, the fact that there's that electronic barrier again means that the driver doesn't have to look the passenger in the eye the same way that a cab driver would, however briefly, have to look a black person in the eye if they choose to drive past them without picking them up.
I did an interview last year when Uber first started here in New York with an African-American woman who said she loved Uber, and the reason why was explicitly because it solved, she thought, the prejudice problem. She said that taxis wouldn't pick her up. Uber solved those problems.
That is not inconsistent with racial minorities still potentially being treated worse than white people via the rating system that Uber uses. And so while it may be that Uber makes it easier for minorities to get access to transportation, that doesn't necessarily mean that racial minorities are getting the same access to transportation.
So the Uber driver that I talked to about this, he seems to think that the customer rating system is a good idea, that it makes his job easier, he can avoid problem clients. Can't this rating system be a good thing for weeding out the bad apples out there or giving people an incentive to be better customers, to set a tone of civility?
I absolutely think that there should be some mechanism for drivers to rate passengers as well as passengers to rate drivers. Having said that, I think that there's a problem with transparency. The passenger doesn't know what her rating is unless she can persuade a driver to tell her.
Or even that she is being rated.
Or even that she is being rated, right? Like, this is not something that's widely known, because when you log into your Uber account, there's no rating there. Even if they know they're being rated, they don't know why they get a good rating or a bad rating. If they don't know why they're getting poor ratings, that really takes that incentive to be better passengers away or makes it less useful. And what a lot of the social science research has shown is that implicit bias is most problematic when there aren't guidelines, when there's just this unfettered discretion on the part of the person who's doing the evaluation.
So, Nancy, you're not the only one to express concern over Uber's rating system. Earlier this month, the Florida Taxi Cab Association called the Uber rating practice dangerous and discriminatory, pointing out that it could have a negative impact on, for example, elderly riders who might need more assistance.
Yeah.
The Florida Taxi Cab Association, obviously they have an angle on this, that they don't want competition from Uber.
Sure.
And then there's me with my hurt feelings. But do you see any real legal implications for this customer rating system?
There is a statute that was enacted after the Civil War in order to prevent discrimination by private parties. And what it essentially says is
all citizens of the United States have the same right to make and enforce contracts as white citizens. Well, when a person contacts a company that offers the service of driving passengers from one place to another and indicates their desire to take advantage of that service, that's a textbook example of an effort to make and enforce a contract. And if, due to the Uber rating system, it's easier for white people to form that contract than for people of other races, that sounds like a situation where people of other races are not being given the opportunity to make and enforce contracts to the same degree as white citizens. With respect to people with disabilities, the Americans with Disabilities Act reaches private companies as well. And if we were able to find that passengers with disabilities were rated worse and that the rating system over time led to people with disabilities waiting much longer for a car to come and pick them up, then I could see that potentially giving rise to a claim as well. All of these rating systems, while they certainly do have advantages, they also have ways in which people can manifest prejudices against various groups, whether they're doing so on purpose or without knowing it.
Nancy Leong is a professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. Nancy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, too. It's a pleasure to be here.
Uber declined our request for an interview. It did point us to a new blog entry that it posted just this week, which said, quote, "An Uber trip should be a good experience for drivers, too. Drivers shouldn't have to deal with aggressive, violent, or disrespectful riders." If a customer posting a negative review is a sort of punishment, it turns out that the subject of a grievance can punish right back. Jen Palmer is an executive assistant in the Salt Lake City area, and her review of an online business turned into a 6-year legal rabbit hole.
I've never regretted leaving that review. If things were different, I probably would have left exactly the same review, even knowing what was going to happen later.
Alex Goldmark produces my podcast, New Tech City, and he's been following this cautionary tale of e-commerce and free speech.
It was Christmas time in 2008, and Jen Palmer's husband, John, was browsing online for a little present. Nothing fancy.
I think originally what he was trying to get me was one of those little perpetual motion desk toys and a little smiley face bendy keychain. I mean, we're literally talking about less than $20 worth of stuff.
But after the tchotchkes never showed up, Jen wanted to know why.
I started emailing, I started calling, could never get anybody on the phone.
Thank you for calling cleargear.com. A customer representative is unavailable by phone at this time.
So I said, you know what, I'm writing a review on these people because this is just ridiculous.
Her review was scathing, she admits, but nobody, not even ClearGear, has said it was false. So it was a total surprise when 2 years later, Jen's husband got an email from the company with an ultimatum.
And it was somebody claiming to be their legal counsel. They said, this is on you to take it down, and if you don't take it down within 72 hours, we're going to fine you $3,500.
The Palmers refused to pay, and sure enough, 90 days later, their credit monitoring service alerted them to a debt of $3,500. ClearGear had treated the fine as an unpaid bill, and John's credit was trashed.
As soon as that happened, we both hit the roof.
The website claimed that by buying something from their online store, John Palmer had agreed to a clause in their terms of service that said he could not disparage the company anywhere, not even on other sites. I called ClearGear for comment, and I got the same answering machine message that Jen Palmer got when she tried to contact them, and I also got no response to an email through their website. As it turns out, there was no such clause in the terms of service agreement on ClearGear's site until after the Palmers attempted the purchase. But the order of events, it doesn't really matter here.
My name is Scott Michaelman. I'm an attorney with Public Citizen, and I'm counsel for the Palmers.
It's the idea of a non-disparagement clause that worries Michaelman.
Just by contacting a consumer and telling him or her, you must take your criticism down, the company has succeeded in intimidating the consumer and possibly deterring other consumers from posting criticism of that company.
Jen Palmer spent about a year petitioning the credit bureaus and appealing two loan decisions that levied higher borrowing rates on her husband. It was a lot to go through because of one online review about a keychain and a desktop doohickey. But in the end, she was successful.
John's credit has now been cleared. We can move on with our lives and try to make up for the last year.
And by moving on, she means they're suing ClearGear for damages. Now, if this whole saga seems crazy, if it seems out of proportion for a business to be so tenacious and to pitch such a fight over one bad review, consider just how much a negative online comment can matter.
Small businesses can be ruined by defamation.
Joe Hadid runs a carpet cleaning company in Virginia. He was hit with a series of negative reviews on Yelp, and then, he says, his business started to drop off. The thing is, Hadid claims, those comments weren't all from actual customers.
For example, there was a negative review from New Jersey, where we don't do business. We checked the reviews against our records, and we couldn't identify any real customers that matched the reviews.
This is something a lot of small business owners complain about.
What you're seeing is scores of people who feel that they've been maligned unfairly and that there is really nothing they can do about it.
Rennie Delaney is the lawyer representing Joe Hadid. And with Delaney's help, Hadid is trying to get Yelp to turn over the names of the commenters so that he can sue them for defamation. But Yelp says, nope. And a Yelp spokesperson wrote via email that most commenters aren't anonymous, but sometimes they do have good reason to be. Like if they want to review a plastic surgeon or if they fear retribution. She also added that Joe Hadid has not actually shown that anything said about him on Yelp was untrue. Rennie Delaney.
What's at stake in this case in the larger picture is two competing rights. And, you know, one of the rights is the right to free speech and the right to speak anonymously. And the other right is the right to protect your reputation.
So if the process of unmasking an anonymous commenter is too easy, then defamation lawsuits could be used to intimidate real consumers. If it's too hard to find out who's slandering you online, then business owners are basically being told to just sit there and take it. One of the other questions before the Virginia Supreme Court, which is currently considering this case, is should a small business have to prove a commenter is faking it, or just have some good faith reason to suspect it?
The problem with that is there's a First Amendment right to speak anonymously in this country.
You might remember this guy from earlier.
My name is Scott Michaelman. I'm an attorney with Public Citizen, and I represent Yelp.
Michaelman defended the Palmer's right to comment on ClearGear, and he's defending Yelp's right to protect the identity of its commenters. He especially likes to defend the rights of commenting anonymously.
That's very important because if you advocate an unpopular cause, if you are at risk of retaliation because of your speech, sometimes you want to share ideas with others and yet not reveal who you are.
In the web-based economy, where a few bad reviews can sink a small company, we'll likely be seeing more lawsuits like Hadid's against Yelp and ClearGear's against the Palmers. Because, well, the negative comment is here to stay.
If only good reviews get up, we're like Lake Wobegon. Everyone is above average.
And we can't all live there. I'm Alex Goldmark. Goldmark, not Goldman.
Alex Goldmark is the producer of my podcast, New Tech City. Come check us out on iTunes. We're not your typical tech show.
I am happy to report that there are places where civilian comment is a safe and civil enterprise. The letters to the editor section of a newspaper. If the op-ed section is a soapbox for the brash and voluble, the letters section is a gentle preceding a terse remark. As Polonius said, brevity is the soul of wit, a message lost on many an opinionator, but not on Felicia Nemu Ackerman, who is among the most published letter writers on the Eastern Seaboard. A professor of philosophy at Brown, Ackerman is a fixture in the letter sections of the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Wall Street Journal. Since 1987, more than 200 of her letters have been printed in the Times alone. Felicia Nemu, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
200 is a large number, but it says nothing of your success rate. How many letters do you write before you get one published on average?
Way more. I really want to stress this. A very, very small percentage of my letters get published. This is not a hobby for anyone who cannot tolerate rejection.
We're now living in a digital age where everybody can be published. Now that we're amid this glut of opinionation, is what you do less relevant, more relevant, what?
Naturally, I would ask, relevant to what? What I try to do is give opinions that would be unlikely to be heard elsewhere. There was an article in the New York Times in 2002 about the film Tuck Everlasting, where William Hurt, the star of the film, was quoted as saying, "Most people think of life as a story of life and death. Death is a bookend. Take that bookend away and what have you got?" And I wrote, "This is typical of attempts to sugarcoat death. Here is an alternative metaphor. Death is a punch in the jaw. Take away that punch and what have you got? An intact jaw." In the constant pressure nowadays to accept and sugarcoat death, I think saying the death simply stinks comes off as a mildly unusual idea.
If I can discern any trend in what you've written over the years, contrarian springs pretty immediately to mind. I want you to read, if you would, please, a letter that you wrote in not praise of the poet Joyce Kilmer, famous for the schoolroom classic Trees.
Oh, I just said it was two lines. I think that if I had a choice, I'd never read a fool like Joyce.
I've never read any kind of criticism of Joyce, much less a broadside like that.
The article that it commented on in the book review, I think it was called A Tree Grows and Grows, did quote a number of people who didn't like Joyce, although it also quoted people who praised him. But I think he's just mawkish and ridiculous.
At this stage, I want to actually bring in Tom Fayer, your editor at the New York Times. He edits the letters section. And I understand this is the first time you're meeting, so go crazy.
Hi, nice to meet you.
And so, and likewise to you, as Sir Thomas Mallory would say.
Tom, I am curious to know what constitutes a successful letters to the editor writer.
There is a certain formula. You write briefly, you respond to an article. We tend to have a limit of roughly 150 words. You say something smart, to the point. Felicia Nemu certainly knows how to do it.
Do you have a particular favorite among her 200 missives?
Well, I've been the letters editor since 1999, so I can't say that I've read all 200. Actually, it's 226, according to a search in my Nexus database. There was one June 7th, 2013. It was referring to an article, "Too Old to Judge, Albany Considers Raising Age Limits for States Courts." And she wrote, "Rather than treating judges as incompetent once they reach a certain age, New York should rely on non-discriminatory procedures for removing all incompetent judges from office, regardless of age." I think that is a somewhat typical letter in that one of your things is prejudice against old people.
I'm 66 now, but I've been concerned with that. In fact, I've had that all my life.
Felicia Nemu, it's one thing to have a bête noire, as I believe you could describe your feelings about age discrimination in all of its forms, and another to have a hobby horse that you can be depended on to just constantly flog. Have you been cautioned by Tom or anybody else about riding the horse just too hard?
Not really, and I think that's partly because I write letters on a lot of other subjects too. For example, I'm very interested in the discrimination and hostility toward fat people. I used to be fat, although I'm not now. The assumption that people who overeat have eating disorders, but people who take risks by climbing mountains don't have mountaineering disorders. I'm very out of sympathy with the therapeutic view of life, which takes unconventionality to be a kind of mental illness. I'm very concerned about privacy in the workplace, the idea that your employer should not be telling you what to eat, what kind of health habits to have, what to do in your free time, and so forth. I'm concerned about self-righteousness, people who criticize other people for using air conditioning, for example. I'm concerned about internet bashing. One of my most recent letters in the magazine said, "If you can't experience the real world by sitting in front of a screen, how can you experience by reading?" Books divert our attention from the world around us, too, and it's a good thing. Books and screens let us exercise our uniquely human capacity to transcend our immediate surroundings and enter the world of the imagination. So I write about quite a lot of things other than old age.
I want to ask you one final thing, Felicia Nemu. Most writers who have enduring relationships with editors have relationships with those editors, and yet this is really the first time you and Tom have ever spoken. Now that you have his undivided attention, face-to-face, more or less, have you anything you'd like to share?
Basically, that I'm pleased when he runs my letters, and I think they're intelligently edited, and I'm happy with the whole situation. I realize this is most uninteresting, but in fact, it's what my reaction is.
Would you like redirect, Tom?
One suggestion I would make, and you can disregard it if you like, because you send so many letters, obviously if you send 5 letters a day, which you sometimes do, we're going to run at most one of those letters. So if you have a particular favorite, let me know. Not that that guarantees we'll pick it, but I won't have to choose among the 5.
Thank you very much. I will do that in the future.
Well, I must say that for OTM's part, I'm just so happy that we could have made this encounter possible, and I'm getting a little choked up. Felicia Nemu, Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Felicia Nemu Ackerman is a prolific letter writer and professor of philosophy at Brown University. Tom Fayer is the letters editor for the New York Times. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, BJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Mira Sharma. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited this week by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Leslie Sisson.
Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote the theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.